Welcome, ladies, to the show. Today's going to be an exciting show. I think it's one of the topics that are that needs to be spoken about. It's not spoken about enough.
Yes.
And since it is Mental Health Awareness Month, so today we are going to be covering bipolar disorder. So yes. Let's begin with, first, you know what? I would love it if you guys can introduce yourselves.
Sure.
So tell us a little about you and what you do, and and we can
put them on top. Okay. Well, my name is Angelina Hudson. I work for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Greater Houston. I've been with the organization for 24 years, the first 10 years as a volunteer, and the last 14 years as a staff member. And we are dedicated to improving the lives of those living with mental illness, both those diagnosed and the people who love them, the family members. And so I come to this topic as a person who first sat in a seat in a NAMI class needing help because I had children diagnosed with brain disorder and mental health conditions, behavioral health conditions to be more specific. And so NAMI does not diagnose, we do not treat, but we help people walk the journey with dignity and respect, and we help people live the best life they can with the illnesses in recovery.
Yes, I love that. As long as I've been a clinician, I've known about NAMI.
Okay.
And that's why I'm so excited that Angelina's here, because being on the clinical side is very different, because people are, you know, usually in a crisis or they're desperate for a diagnosis. And so having organizations like NAMI for families who need a support system,
mm-hmm.
and NAMI does a wonderful job. My background as a clinician is, it's going on 24 years.
Wow.
And my specialty is in marriage and family, but I have worked in inpatient settings and have done the diagnosis deal and treated a lot of bipolar adolescents, actually, in my career. When I was at DevRo for 11 years, most of my clients had comorbidities, which in our terminology, it means they have more than one diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, people with bipolar end up in inpatient settings when things get really bad, or it's a comorbid occurrence with like substance abuse, or they end up breaking the law and they end up in the system. So it is one of the more serious ones of the category of mood disorders. It's a little bit more complex. I know that the media, you know, the term bipolar is very misused.
Casual. It's casual.
And mm-hmm. and it's kind of turned into, oh, she's so bipolar.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't do it enough justice, because if you have to live with that, it's actually a very serious thing for everyone involved, the loved ones and the person living that roller coaster. Imagine being on a roller coaster ride that never stops.
Never stops.
Yeah.
So
since we're on that, what is bipolar disorder and how does it affect individuals?
So bipolar disorder, and I know Angelina can add a whole lot more. Today I wanted to take the angle of the impact like on the system, but bipolar is a mood disorder, but it's not a mood disorder like major depression, you know, depression. In depression, we stay kind of on the low and we need essentially a pick-me-up. So you can get on an SSRI, you can, you know, pick up walking, you can eat differently, you can do a lot with just simple depression disorder or even anxiety. But with bipolar, there is this component where not only do you experience a low mood, like usually the low mood is a lot longer than the mania. So the mania for everyone is different depending on what type of bipolar they're diagnosed with. That's why as a clinician, you never want to jump the gun on diagnosing, which I think Angelina will go into that a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have a relationship with your provider long enough to track these patterns, because it could look like major depression. It could look like a teenager with ADHD,
mm-hmm.
because mania could look kind of hyper in some ways, you know, like it could look like a lot of different things, but it needs a very good assessment an observation. So a lot of times I used to have my kiddos keep journals, and I wanted to track like what the mania looks like and how they look in a depressive mode. So even medically, then you have to convey as a clinician, then we have to communicate that accurately to either like a pediatrician or the PCP or a psychiatrist if the mania is very troublesome. So it's kind of like mapping out the disease.
Yeah.
And sometimes they like their mania.
Yes, so mania feels good.
Yes.
Because you feel sexy.
They achieve a lot.
You feel great.
They achieve a lot
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah.
And
you know, it's funny you said that, because every time when I go to the doctors, my kid's pediatrician, they always give me this huge list of questions to ask. And on there, they're asking about their mood, how they're doing in school.
That depression inventory.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm just like, I never knew why, but that makes sense. So they want to know, like...
BDI? Is it the form called BDI?
I don't know what the form is.
Okay. Mm-hmm. A lot of PCPs have started that, and it's wonderful.
Questions like how they're doing in school. Do they talk about... harming themselves, you know, things like that. I'm just like, oh, wow, why would a pediatrician want to know all that? But now that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, children go to the pediatrician for 18 years, right? Mm-hmm. And so they've established this relationship. History. They trust them. Mm-hmm. They feel like this person is, and usually that pediatrician is real pretty. And so they just really buy into it. And so early on, the son who I have that's the least adherent to any type of treatment protocol. He likes her so much that he'll talk to her about anything.
Wow.
And that was one of the ways that we helped him early on.
Yeah.
So I came into NAMI because I have children diagnosed. Who gives up on children? No one. Mm-hmm. And the first one didn't speak for 7 years. So I have one child diagnosed with autism. But 28 years ago, no one used that term. Was not very... And so I suffered with, oh, there's nothing wrong with him. You just need to wait a while. 7 years. Wow. And so... but that's how I came to NAMI. But the other two children were diagnosed with ADHD early on. Mm-hmm. One at 3, the other one at 6. And the reason they were diagnosed, the 6-year-old, the oldest child, presented as if she was hard of hearing or deaf.
Oh.
Right?
Okay.
So she started in first grade, and she wouldn't answer her name. But she talked to us at home, but they could call her, and she would be so deep in her thoughts, she was unaware. They found out that she had auditory processing disorder. Mm-hmm. The auditory process, and even at lunch, you know how the cafeteria line, they ask you, what do you want to eat? She would never pick. And then she would just say yes, because she was so afraid that she was upsetting them. Mm-hmm. And so then she was accepting things on her plate that she was allergic to. And we were like, no, you know, like cheese and dairy.
God.
And I'm like, no, she can't have that. So they found out, they asked us to have her tested.
Yeah.
And boy, the day I cried when I found out that her ABR score was very high, meaning there was nothing wrong with her actual ear. The part of the ear that hears.
Yeah.
Then they said, we have to do a brain scan. And the terror, because I had one child who had already gone through MRIs and PET scans, and he had a severe brain disorder.
Yeah.
So I didn't want anything to be wrong with perfect Olivia, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was tragic and a blessing at the same time. Mm-hmm. Because she was caught so early, she was able to read and speak and everything on grade level by the third grade, right, with the right intervention.
Yeah.
So her ADHD through school was managed, identified, she was supported.
Yeah.
She did, believe it or not, she did best at oral tests where she was away from everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so she did exemplary in school. But as a young adult, you know, she ventured off, okay, mama, I'm an adult. I don't need you. I can do it myself. And 70% of children with ADHD go on to have a secondary diagnosis. So when they called us and told us to pick her up from college, that's when she received the diagnosis of bipolar disorder with OCD features. OCD does not mean monk, though. Like, I thought OCD was like, you're really clean. I thought, oh, great, she's going to come home. She's going to clean the house.
Like,
she's going to keep
one of
everything.
Those.
No. OCD has 5 subtypes.
Yes.
And so she's my anxious baby. My Yahoo, the baby, we knew something was wrong day one. I mean, he taught himself how to ride a bike. He potty trained himself. He taught himself how to swim against the wishes of the YMCA. Mm-hmm. They had to put him out. He got put out of everything. He went to a gifted and talented school in the fourth grade. They put him out. So behavior has always been an issue.
Yeah.
With his diagnosis, and his earliest diagnosis was ADHD and ODD, oppositional defiant disorder.
But that one, you gotta be careful. That one's very much skewed.
Yeah, I think it was more of the ADHD and a little bit of paranoia on his part, which was making him non-compliant, because it's morphed into adult bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. He was diagnosed by Dr. Victor Odorende. He's now at Cypress Creek Hospital. I just found out. I can't wait to reconnect with him, because that was the only psychiatrist as a teenager that he would listen to.
Oh, wow.
And since. Then and since.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try to reconnect with him. You have to have a clinician to work effectively with someone diagnosed with bipolar disorder. They have to have a strong relationship. There has to be mutual respect. If that doesn't exist, then that patient is going to feel like they're not understood.
Yeah.
They're not going to believe that you understand them well enough to medicate them, and they won't stay connected to the protocol. That's what I have
found.
And
some of the behaviors that especially adolescents engage in during mania, it's associated with a lot of shame. So you don't want to admit what you did during a manic episode. You know, I had a client that I started coaching. She's actually from, she was Middle Eastern, and this was the first time she was going to live away from college. And I got a call. I was like, I was at my parents' house for something. And I get this weird call from the campus at UT Dallas, the social worker. And I'm like, okay, I have to take this. Like, my phone would not stop. And so I went I left the house so I can have privacy. And apparently, she did, like you said, she did not have a good transition going to college. She really started like being extremely promiscuous, and this is coming from a household of like, you know, you never have sex until you meet the one, and then we arrange that one for you, to having like, you know, I'm talking two-digit amount of partners. In freshman year, and then drove herself into a deep, deep depression. I mean, who can she call with that?
Yeah.
But, you know, luckily we had a rapport from me helping her before on some other issue. And it was tricky because she was away from home. She didn't have the support she needed. You know, thank God the social worker was able to connect her, because in bipolar disorder, you don't just need an antidepressant. You also need a mood stabilizer. So you have this kind of like, and you know, I'm not a psychiatrist, but typically the teenagers that I've worked with, they were always on a combo cocktail, what we called it. And you have to work with your psychiatrist to get the right one for you. There's no one right formula for every person, because metabolically we look different.
And it changes.
Yeah, and the medications, we can, like, maybe one medication will plateau and it's not as effective. And then the female, you know, we always have our hormones.
And we have babies.
You have babies. So being bipolar and being pregnant is a whole other story.
Can't take it, yeah.
Yeah, so it was really tricky, and I just remember begging her, because she was like a superstar, like this is a pre-med person, right? To the rest of the world, she's that child everybody wants. She gets into UT, high honors, heading off to med school. Nobody knows about this other life that she's living, and at times it gets to the point where she literally doesn't want that life anymore. She doesn't want to be in that life. So it's a lot of teaching, coping skills, recognizing, you know, there's a technique with DBT where you help, it's not just teenagers, it's people living with bipolar, understand their regulation, and then how they're impacted in their relationship systems, right? So a lot of times bipolar looks like very interrupted relationships, because they often burn people out. People who, they love being close to them, because I'm telling you, manic people are a lot of fun.
They're
in
a lot of fun.
You know, they're the funnest friends.
And they're big dreamers.
But not when you have to
bail
them out of jail. Not when you have to put up with the damage they cause.
Pay the
debts. You know, it's quite taxing on family members and the friends that are close enough to get to know. And so what you see over the lifespan is a very disruptive relationship pattern.
Mm-hmm. And the thing about it is, and there's two things I want to share in addition to that. That was very good outline, Mutab. In the beginning, you don't know what you're looking at in any of the diagnoses, really. But I remember understanding and beginning to accept autism, right? I'm like, okay, we're in. Mm-hmm. I remember at age 4, I thought, okay, we're in for the long haul. There's no quick fix. There's no magic pill. We're going to have to learn, you know. And so I started reading books written by adults who were diagnosed with autism. Temple mm-hmm. Grandin was my first one, which was really one of the best ones because she has such a good memory, and her earliest books described a level of autism that my son actually had. You know, the mutism and all of that. She had all of that also until age 5. And then reading books written by men, you know, mm-hmm. with autism. It just really helped me understand my son. Until now, he can talk to me and tell me more than I want to know. but that's been a journey. And when you say to someone, oh, he has autism, people go, oh, you know, he's such a good guy. I'm like, no, he just doesn't talk to you, and you don't know what he's really thinking. The child with bipolar, no one says, oh. You know,
like,
people like, get away.
Yeah.
You know, it's like taboo. And the tragic part of it is they're just as a victim of their brain disorder as the child with autism. But they're not viewed that way. So while the one with autism was always cared for by the entire staff, mm-hmm. the administrators, there was so much empathy for him. And then my little Yahoo was bouncing off the walls, and teachers would say, no, you shouldn't be that way. And then by December, get him out of my class. And I mean, really angry at things he had said or done or, you know, implicated in. And so it's a tragedy for that person with bipolar disorder, because they're so misunderstood. Mm-hmm. And then they feel rejection, even if they're the brightest. I remember this Yahoo of mine made a perfect score on the state exam for math. Wow. And then the very next semester made a whole business mm-hmm. out of selling people passes for being out of class or out of school. And when they found out about it, they were like, I can't believe you did that. I'm like, I can't.
You just reminded me. So, yeah, that's a great point, because oftentimes, I used to joke around this with my kiddos at DevRel. I'd be like, I'm crazy, but I'm not stupid.
Right.
And I kept repeating that. And I even later on in my life met a guy who did true. 2 degrees at the same time. He was bipolar. So in the same 4-year span, well, 3 years, he knocked out law school
mm-hmm.
and dental school.
Mm-hmm. He just made a 1380.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely they do not lack brain power.
And they know
it. It's the emotional regulation.
It's the emotional regulation.
Taxing the downs, because mm-hmm. they spend more time in the downs.
In my family, we didn't use these terms. So growing up as a child, you know, we had family members that clearly at the family picnic were like, okay, here she come again, you know. And we knew, but no one, tragically, I think, no one really sought professional help. And that's just a historic thing with our family. We take care of those who need to be taken care of, but you don't rely on any kind of system. And I remember when my son, again, this was at 4, when we told the whole family, this is permanent, he's not going to outgrow autism. My dad said, look, and my dad was born in 1929 in East Texas. And he said to me, Angelina, we're going to build a room in the back of the house, and we're going to make him comfortable, but y'all need to stop taking him out. You know, just leave him home when you go to the grocery store and the church and all that. And I said to him, I said, no, we're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. I said, because he's going to have to learn how to live in a world that either receives him or doesn't receive him, even after I'm gone. So the idea for me was to get him acclimated to what his life is going to look like now, so that when we're no longer here, he can continue to thrive. Mm-hmm. But if we take care of him like that, what happens when no one can take care of him? So we need to build him up as much as we can. So, but I just wanted to say that because in a lot of cultures, that still exists. You keep him in the back room. You take care of him. Bipolar, schizophrenia, schizoaffect, doesn't matter. You keep him in the back room best you can.
It's painful.
Yeah, and it's sad. And the tragedy is then that person is never in the driver's seat of their own future.
Yeah.
They never really get to their optimum self, their best self. And then you've taken that away from them. Mm-hmm. So I think that in this community, even we talked a little bit before we started about the woman who went to Lakewood, and I remember I was interviewed on Channel 2 about that. And here's the tragedy. A lot of people will say, we saw it coming. She bought bulletproof, but we knew she had guns in the house. She even told the mother-in-law in Mexico, I'm coming, right? And she called, and the mother-in-law called the judge.
Okay, that's not bipolar.
No. I'm bringing it up because if we don't as a society decide to do something different, though, like people never get to healing and recovery. They don't get there. I think the best thing that has ever happened to my youngest son, who's diagnosed with bipolar, is that he goes, Mom, I know you talk about it all the time. And I know you tell people I have bipolar disorder, but I don't accept it.
No.
Now, he accepts he's different, right?
Yeah.
He knows he's got stuff. I don't care what you call it. I don't. You know, potato, patata, right?
Yeah.
You could call it Yankee Doodle. I don't care what you call it.
Yeah.
As long as you're aware and you're taking care of yourself. And so I think the things that will show up in bipolar, if you're a family member and you don't know what you're looking at, is they cannot maintain consistency with either going to school, if they're K through 12 or college, or going to work if they're adults, right? They're going to constantly change jobs. It's never going to be their fault. It's going to be somebody else's fault. But they, according to them, it could be their fault. But they have a hard time keeping a job.
Yeah.
Or they go to work and then they're really not productive. They're like, but eventually that ends with they don't have a job. So they're constantly losing stuff, you know. In terms of their finances, because they're constantly and repeatedly unemployed. The second thing is they can't take care of their daily function. And that has a lot to do with their sleep pattern, right? They'll go days of sleeping and days of not sleeping and days of sleeping and days of not sleeping. And then when I say they can't take care of their daily function, I mean on a weekly basis, they're losing their keys, their wallet, their phone. They lose the whole darn car if you're not careful. They lose things. Or they're forgetful, you know, they can't make it anywhere on time, which is one of the reasons why they can't keep the job. But, you know, they have a hard time like paying their bills. They may have a bank account full of money, full of money. That's if they trust the bank. Otherwise, it's in the attic. But if they have money, but they don't attend. They don't attend to the daily functions that are required to live independently and not in my house. And then the third thing is they don't enjoy a lot of satisfying relationships. Those relationships that they've made very, very young, they can keep those because they made it at a time before the bipolar or whatever grew out of control. So like those earliest attachments, they've got them.
Mm-hmm.
But new relationships are next to Neil. So a lot, and then our society doesn't help with that, swipe left, swipe right, because they don't have to make relationships, right? They can use these new social media.
It actually triggers them to go, you know, downward
spiral.
Yeah.
Right? So Instagram, Facebook, okay, don't want to get sued by social media, but, you know, social media is good, but everything in moderation, right? One of the things that I'm blessed with the Yahoo is not only does he have bipolar disorder, he has a little bit of OCD. Which is about germs and contaminants, which is why he stopped eating dairy. He just watched this How It's Made show, and he said, okay, that's it for me. But he started vaping. And that THC, man, that can just destroy a bipolar brain, right?
Yeah.
So you know what I said? How many people touched that before you bought it?
Ooh, that's a good one.
How many hands has that transferred? And if there's no regulation on what's in it, then how do you know? How do you know? And he goes, you're right. And he quit. Like at 17. He's 23 now.
Yeah, when you live with bipolar, you are almost set up for an addiction.
Thank you for saying that.
And that's why something people don't talk about. It's, yes, you can't keep a relationship, you can't keep up with classes or sustain a, you know, normal job pattern. But that brain, the need for that excitement, you mentioned about insomnia. You can talk to someone living with bipolar and they'll say, I can stay up for 3 days.
3 or 4 days, yeah.
And, you know, that sounds really cool when you're in college.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But when you're a clinician diagnosing, you're like, no. Oh, tell me more.
The first time he said, Mom, he got a full scholarship. He has, you know, he made a 1380 on the SAT. So he had scholarships coming from everywhere. He finally accepted this one university. He went there for 1 week. He called me and said, I can't live in this dorm. These people are nasty. Da-da-da. You know, the whole cleanliness thing kicked in again. And he was on a football. He also was a star football player. That's another thing. The cheer of the crowd. Oh, that football made it was everything to him. And so he said, I'm just going to sleep in my car. Well, do you know at NAMI how many people I know sleep in their car?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, come home. And he did. Mm-hmm. And he opened up 3 companies. Not one, not two, mm-hmm. three.
There you go.
Two failed,
they're
one
extra.
Kept going.
They're
extra. Yeah.
Well, let's hold that thought real quick. We're going to take a really quick break. You are listening to 103.5 Hum FM with your Chai Time Girls. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Hum FM on 103.5 FM with your Chai Time Girls. For those of you who have just tuned in, we are in conversation with Miss Angelina and Mehtab on bipolar disorder. This was a very interesting topic, so let's continue where we left off.
Yeah, so one of the things, I know we've talked about a lot of things kind of could go bad for a person,
yes.
But I do want to really emphasize that you once you recognize and you build that relationship with a provider and you map out your highs and your lows and you get medicated appropriately, you can live a normal life, a fulfilling life, but you have to be transparent. You have to own the process, just like, you know, when we are diagnosed with diabetes.
You have to own it.
If we change our lifestyle, if we take our medication, some people have even reversed it, you mm-hmm. know, or really minimized the impact of the disease on their system. So I want to share a story of a case that I had maybe 5 years into my career, and we still kind of stay in touch here and there, and she's, I would say, my success story of someone living with bipolar. She was adopted, so she had, the parents had no idea what they were getting into, and she had a late adolescent onset, and I met her well into her 20s, and she comes from a very good family. She was had an MBA degree, doing great work, but where she got to see me is when she literally spent, I think it was like $34,000 in like a weekend and had to move back home with her parents. And so her father was like, okay, we need to get you help. And of course, you know, I always feel like people who adopt kids are already kind of special anyway. They let someone into the, you know, their heart. And so I had a lot of respect for this family. But I remember when we started mapping out her her cycles, one of the things that I would notice, and I love that Angelina's wearing this color pink, when a manic episode was around the corner, she had this one lipstick.
Pink.
And that's how I knew, because she was very pretty lady too, like always in these like workout clothes and look like really pulling it off and looking good in them. But she loved her grays and black, and I'm like, uh-oh,
we're pink again.
I see the pink lipstick, and we just had we had fun with it. And I said, did you put half, you know, your first paycheck in your dad's account?
Exactly.
You know, like we had these little systems in place,
yeah,
so that she could live with her disease and still be successful in life, but she had parameters. And what I loved about her family was everybody had the buy-in. Like the dad knew that she would, yes, she was very successful making 6 figures, but she was going to get a very big allowance, but it was the main money was going to stay with Dad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that when she would have those impulsive urges, we had a check system.
We're doing the same thing, Matab. We've been looking into a family trust,
mm-hmm.
Because right now my youngest son, believe it or not, trusts my mom more than he trusts me because his dad has access to me, right? So he's like, no, your accounts are joint,
okay.
You know. And so he worships my mom. He sees her as a very patient. She has always treated him in the same way. I think that this has been mm-hmm. a generational thing, this bipolar thing. It's just that my family was the first family to go get a diagnosis.
Yeah.
And so my mom is very tolerant. And she's, you know, and so people who tend to have any type of frailty, whether it's chronic or diagnosed mm-hmm. or undiagnosed, they tend to lean on her. She's the whole block's like rock or whatever. And so
yeah.
the same with him. But one day she won't be here, right? So
yeah.
we're doing that transition now into a trust and an IRA so he can start having a place with some accountability.
Yeah.
So that he doesn't continue. He's 23. He opened up 3 companies after losing 4 jobs when he was 18. And let me just say this to be very transparent to those listening. It gets ugly before it gets better.
Oh, yeah.
When he lost the first 4 jobs in 2 months, I said, oh, boy. I knew mm-hmm. what I was looking at because of the Dr. Oterindi diagnosis and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he wouldn't take medication. He wouldn't stand to listen to me. So I left him. I moved out of the house, lock, stock, and barrel, my homestead. And I said, let's see what happens. So
mm-hmm.
when the water got turned off, he said, so when are you going to turn on the water? I said, whenever you pay it. And then when the lights got cut off, the neighbors called me and said, oh, Miss Angelina, he doesn't have light. I said, oh, boo. He
mm-hmm.
needs to work.
Mm-hmm.
And until he figures that part out, that every tub has to stand on its own bottom,
uh-huh.
I'm not moving back in. And so we went through this rough patch. So just to be real, NAMI has helped me through the free psychoeducation classes and the support groups. I have listened for 20 years to other people's stories. And so the parts that helped me is the psychoeducation. Understand, I had to first understand it wasn't my fault. The first
mm-hmm.
reaction a person has is sorrow, shame, and then blame.
Mm-hmm.
Whose fault is it? And so
yeah.
NAMI's classes help you understand as a caregiver, family member, loved one. It helps you understand where you are. Because even though they're the one with the diagnosis, you're very foolish if you think it doesn't. It's your diagnosis too, if you're going to continue to love that person. So you have to find your boundaries. You have to find what you will do, what you won't do.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a lot of decisions to make along the way. And then, and they help you kind of look at your options. The second thing is the anecdotal stories. Hearing what other people have,
yeah.
that's why I tell people all the time I moved out my own house. Because that's a wild thing to do. It really is. But it worked.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he still loves me. I still love him. Nobody went to jail. He's not, because, you know, it could happen. And
yeah.
He's not under a bridge. You see, all of these things I avoided.
Even what you talk about jail, a lot of my clients, their parents, like, yeah, I said, probably jail is a very safe place right now. You know, for males. Like,
yeah.
for the, it gets to that point, like she said, where the whole family, like it or not, has to get involved. But it's that elephant in the room that everyone has been ignoring.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, yeah, he likes his alcohol. He's like on his 15th drink. No, that's not a normal brain.
That's not a normal brain.
So
right.
don't make it look like fun.
Yeah.
Like, be honest about it.
Right. And don't right. think they're always just going to grow out of it
yeah.
without a true clinical intervention. So reaching out to
early.
Family support groups. And NAMI's not the only one. There's Shield Bearers. They have a lot of support group. Hope and Healing Center has a lot. I went personally when we started dealing with dual diagnosis,
oh, yeah.
which is bipolar and vaping and marijuana. And I had to go to the Council on Recovery because I just wanted to kill him and tell God he died, or you know, put him
oh
out, you know,
God.
Or put him out, you know.
Call me first.
Well, I went to the council, and they had a parent support group for parents dealing with marijuana,
yeah.
and it saved me. It really did. And they talked to him. At first, they drug tested him because he had been lying, you know. They drug test you first. Yeah. And I think he was just at 18, but he was still very obedient. So he went, right, yeah, with me. But when we got in the car, he said, "Why did you bring me here?" And I said, "Because I needed help. I don't know how to get through to you, and you weren't being honest with me." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Well, I'm never coming back." And I said, "But you need a therapist." He says, "I know. That's why I have you."
Oh, no, no, no.
And I said, "Okay, then we, Miss Family Therapist, right?" Yeah. I said, "If you need me, I need a therapist. And so when we have these discussions, we're going to talk to a family therapist. Because, yeah, honey, I'm going to lose the little brains I have left," you know. And he agreed to that.
Yeah.
So you see what I'm saying? You have to find a place where that loved one that is struggling with bipolar disorder really trust that you're trying to help them. But yeah, sometimes you need help too.
Even normalizing, you know, the way you report, like the same case that I'm talking about, one time it was cute because back then when I had my private practice, I was only working in the evenings. And I said, "What are you doing Saturday? I noticed your lipstick last time we met." And she said, I can't tell anyone this, but I have 3 dates. And I said, "Okay, are you gonna wear the same outfit to all three? Like,
yeah,
how did, like, tell me more, you know?" So exercising like curiosity to really get to know what that brain is telling her, instead of having my own implicit bias of, "Oh my god, what is she doing having 3 days? We just talked about, you know, the relationship, the impulsivity." But meeting her right there and there, because mm-hmm, in that moment, that's where she was at. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I did not want to risk losing her and all the work we had put into our, sure, relationship.
Yeah. Sure.
And so I often say family members, loved ones, practitioners, we're essentially space holders at
times.
That's
what they are.
We just, mm-hmm, hold a space. We may extremely disagree with that space.
Right, right.
But it's very necessary for the long-term gains.
And I'll say to the parents, I grew up in a very, very strict religion doctrine.
Yeah.
And but I recognized, I don't want to say but, and I recognized that my children needed more than I could provide.
We all,
I recognized that very early. Mm-hmm. With all these yahoos in one house, I needed a lot of lifelines. I used to tell people it takes 12 nonprofits for me to stand in front of me. Because I used all of them. ADDA is for ADHD. I used DBSA for bipolar. I joined a lot of support groups, and I got a lot of information. Because if you're going to do that for diabetes, mm-hmm, if you're going to do that for any other chronic medical condition, why not also do that for a mental health, yeah, condition? But what I wanted to say is my children have, now my son doesn't have a clinician, but he does, mm-hmm, have a confidant.
Good.
And it's not me. And they may or may not believe, like right now he wants to be a sovereign citizen. I know he got that from that confidant, right? And I'm like, "No, you need your social security number, you know,
yeah,
like, file taxes, do it this year." Then my daughter has her own clinician. And I hear them, you know, laughing and talking, and I don't feel bad. Yeah. But I think sometimes as parents, if we don't want to just lose the entire war, we have to give up some of the battles. And so, yeah, for me, that was allowing people who may not believe like I believe, have access to my children so that the children can tell the truth.
Yeah.
And be honest with someone.
Yeah, transparency is so important in getting an accurate picture of the problem. If you don't have an accurate picture, you can't solve it, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. When people say, "Oh, this doctor met me for 10 minutes and diagnosed me," and then I question that provider. We need to take the time. This is one of those complex diagnoses, mm-hmm, that you need a few months at the minimal. 3 to 6 months, mm-hmm, and ideally up to a year of, I say, let's cover all 4 seasons, mm-hmm, and see how your brain does. And for female patients, I say keep a very good log of your moods, and more specifically for patterns around like hormonal changes.
Mm-hmm. And if it's you, if, yeah, you're the one diagnosed, If you're not really clicking with your clinician, get another one.
You won't share.
You won't. If you find that you walk away thinking, I could have had a VA, or, you know, you withheld information because you felt shame, blame, or guilt with your clinician, then you got to get another clinician. Because you want, you want to feel like you can say anything.
As a clinician, I think half the battle is, like, you have to work on yourself, and then you have to kind of help everyone in the room relax enough to give the information that you need.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, you do whatever it takes, but the last thing is judgment.
Oh, that'll shut everything down.
Because you will
lose
people. Yeah. And, you know, I want one of 50,000 things that Angelina does is she builds communities, and she's very authentic, and she's very transparent about her own experience. And
I love that.
That's NAMI, though.
And somehow,
you should meet the people.
Like, our paths crossed, and, you know, I want Houston to be an exemplary town about, like, we're not going to mess around. We're the medical mecca of the world, and we need to go out there, and we need to show support. Like, this Saturday, go out there. Where you?
Oh, the walk.
Yeah. You forgot the walk.
The walk. So NAMI has the largest mental health walk in the Houston area. Over 3,000 people are coming out on Saturday to walk as loved ones of people diagnosed, those in recovery, the advocates, the clinicians, law enforcement. For years, this is the 18th walk, 18th year. And for years, I thought when we were planning the walk, we were contracting with all these officers. There's like a gugob of officers there. But no, they're volunteering, and they're there because they want to be there. And that just means that's the kind of hug.
Yes.
There's
it's a group hug.
It's a huge group hug. We've got so many things lined up. Let's see, where do I start? So we have officers and constables coming from Fort Bend, Montgomery County, and Harris County. Of course, we're honoring two or three officers who have gone above and beyond to help people in crises with mental health crises. Their families are going to be there. So let me see what else. We have CEOs Against Stigma. So we've launched this initiative called CEOs, and two of the first CEOs to take the pledge, saying that we have opened our policies. You keep your job. We want you to get help. We want to help you bridge that support for medical attention. The one is the CEO of the Dash Dynamos Football Club, the international soccer team. They have a game in Dallas on Saturday, but the CEO and some other representatives will be there. They're bringing a ton of stuff to give away. So if you like soccer, come get all your soccer swag.
I'm bringing my big bag.
Yes, you got to come. And here's fresh off the press, the NCAA champion in gymnastics this year, Morgan Price. She's the first champion from an BCU College to get this high honor. Well, she'll be there to cut the ribbon. She's bringing a few of her teammates from Fisk University. So if you love gymnastics, then you've got to come out. And that's I'm sure our mayor may be there, and we're recognizing him too as the largest Houston CEO who has taken the pledge against stigma. So that's our mayor,
well,
John
Whitmer.
Well,
the mayor's daughter is a clinician.
Yes, she is.
And she's amazing.
And she has a walk team.
Yeah.
Whitmer counselors.
Even Sina will be there.
Even Sina, Rupani Foundation. We have, we have about, 18 psychiatric hospitals that are going to be there.
Wow.
And this is what I tell family members. If you ever had a question for a clinician or a hospital, and you call and nobody answered your question, will come out to the walk. They're going to be there in shorts, t-shirts, and tennis shoes, and they will answer your question face-to-face because they're going to be there. Many CEOs in mental health and behavior health are going to be there on that day. So even some pharmaceutical companies, and there's a lot of giveaways. You don't have to register before the walk. We prefer that you do because it makes the line go faster. But you can register beginning at 7:30 a.m. It'll be at the Sam Houston Park, which is right next to Allen Parkway. We are shutting 10 down Allen Parkway. We are walking. So if you're frustrated with traffic, it's us. We're going to be walking on Allen Parkway from 8:30 to 11. It's 3.2 kilometers, about 2 miles. Mm-hmm. We'll have food trucks. The Turkey Leg Hut is going to be there. Salada is going to be there, and they're giving free giveaways. Oak Farms is going to be there. They're giving free giveaway. It's just a lot. It's a festival and a walk. Yeah. But more than that, it's to say out loud, we have mental illness, or we have someone that we love with mental illness.
Or we lost someone.
We've lost someone with mental illness, but hear us roar. We're going to be there, and we want you to come out and join us. It's free. But it is the way we raise money for the classes. So NAMI has psychoeducation classes and support groups all over Houston. If we're not in your community, call us. We'll open one up there. Especially if you want to volunteer. We need more volunteers. Mm-hmm. But join the walk because, like I said, everybody knows someone. Even if it's not in your family, everybody has a friend, sister friend, cousin friend, somebody that they know that has been impacted by mental illness. And so this is a way to give back, and we want you to come out.
Yeah. Wow. This show has just flown by so quickly. I love having you ladies here because I get so much information always.
And, we're so talkative.
You know, thank you both for being here.
But good stuff. You always share
the plethora of information that we always get from you guys. So thank you so much for being here.